This is Fresh Air. I'm Jerry Gross. We're going to remember Quentin Crisp, who died last Sunday at the age of 90. Crisp became a cult figure after the publication of his autobiography, The Naked Civil Servant. The book was adapted into a film of the same name, starring John Hurt. Crisp came out in 1931 at a time when discretion was the rule for gays. He thrived on exhibitionism. He grew his hair long and dyed it red, polished his nails and tweezed his eyebrows, and wore more lipstick and mascara than was considered proper for women of the time. Walking around the streets of London, he was insulted and mocked by strangers, harassed by police, and beaten by toughs. His overt effeminacy condemned him to a life in the margins of society. Crisp moved to Manhattan at the age of 72. I spoke with him in 1986, when he was in his late 70s. I asked him why he dressed so flamboyantly when he came out, instead of trying to blend in and pass for straight.
I think because I never really had a chance. There are, of course, a lot of homosexual men who look just like people, and they have to choose whether they will make any statement, either implicit or in actual words, about their sex life, or whether they will, as you say, try to pass. As I looked so helpless, so hopeless, and could not really find a way of joining the rest of the human race, and I'm speaking of a time, of course, long before I dyed my hair or plucked my eyebrows or lacquered my nails or any of that rubbish. I never really had a chance. I either had to make a terrible hash of being a real person, or else I had to try to be like myself as well as I knew how. So the problem was not really what I would do, but how I would cope with what I was stuck with. Because even at school, I was an object of comment. Why do you walk like that? Why do you speak like that? Why do you say this? Why do you do that? So that, of course, in the beginning, I did what nearly everybody does. I alternately confirmed and denied. One day I would try to behave like a schoolboy, thinking I can't bear all this persecution. Then the next day, I would give that up, thinking it's all too humiliating. I would go on in the way that seems natural to me. Then the persecution was so great, I thought, no, I can't bear it. I'll go back to trying to be like a person. But by the time I left school altogether, I was nearly 18. And then I thought, well, it's hopeless. I will just be myself and try to endure the consequences. I knew they would be difficult. I didn't know how difficult they would be.
When you decided to be yourself, yeah. You started dressing very extravagantly. How did you dress then when you were young?
Well, of course, by modern standards, my appearance wouldn't be remarkable at all. In New York, on 8th Street, which is called St. Mark's Place, there are people with half their hair green and the other half blue, or the other half shaved off altogether, with Fenimore Cooper hairdos. And they say to me things like, well, what was it? What happened? And if I say, well, I did henna my hair, they say, and then? Because they just can't imagine that anyone in New York would ever be persecuted for what they wore.
So what were you wearing that was as eye-catching and
well,
outstanding?
Well, for instance, I wore a velvet suit, and people came up to me in the street and fingered this suit, saying, where did you get this? And why do you wear this? I wore sandals or even bare feet, and people would stamp on my toes. My hair was hennaed. But of course, as I say, by modern standards, the fact that I wore makeup, or that my eyebrows were plucked, or that my hair was dyed, and they mean nothing now, but they did then.
When you'd walk down the street, people would really notice you. You got beaten up a lot,
too. They would notice you. They would shout at you. They would throw things at you. They would push you around. They would come up and stand in front of you with their faces 1 inch from yours and say, "Who the hell do you think you are?" And, of course, I didn't think I was anybody. I was only living a life which seemed to me to express my peculiarities, my personality.
You've said several times that you had a choice between being yourself or trying to look like a regular person or a human being. Did you feel like something less than a human being? Did you really believe in the inferiority of homosexuality?
I didn't really have any views in the beginning about homosexuality. My problem was never a sexual problem. It was a personality problem. I couldn't adopt all these mannerisms, these affectations, in a sense, that make you like a man. You see, at that time, and still to a large extent in England, you could have made a list of occupations, professions, clothes, gestures, words that were suitable for a man. And then you could have made another list of things which were suitable for a woman. And if you just move backwards and forwards, saying, "I don't really see that all these distinctions are necessary. I am in certain respects masculine. I am detached. I am unemotional. I am constant. And I don't think I have to explain that. But I am also physically weak, with tiny hands and feet, with a high voice. And I don't see why I should try and disguise this. This is simply the way I am."
When you first came out, what were the laws in England pertaining to homosexuality?
I think I'm right in saying that certain acts between men would have been illegal and you could easily go to jail. What most people went to jail for, the people I met when I was young, was, of course, soliciting prostitution. But then you could go to jail because you're a woman prostitute as well. But if you wore makeup or were effeminate, of course it was assumed you were a prostitute, which of course is quite absurd. Nowadays, I don't think this assumption is made anymore. You might dress in a flamboyant way and be a rock star, or indeed just be enjoying yourself. You would still meet the hostility of the world, but you wouldn't, I think, be any longer assumed to be doing something illegal.
Were you frequently harassed by police?
Yes, all the time. The police do everything from just moving you on to giving you a fatherly lecture, to, in the end, finally arresting me. And I was taken into custody, went to a police station. Someone had to bail me out. Then the following day, I was arraigned in a magistrate's court. But the evidence was considered to be insufficient to convict me.
We're listening to a 1986 interview with Quentin Crisp. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1986 interview with Quentin Crisp. He died last Sunday at the age of 90.
Your image of yourself, I think, was very caught up in your appearance and how you looked. Did it trouble you when you started to age?
Yes, it troubles you when you first start to age. Round about in your late 30s, you think, well, one day my looks will no longer be a weapon. Funnily enough, when a program was on television about what people thought about old age, Not one of the people questioned said, I regret the passing of my looks. And I found that extraordinary, because that's the first thing. You don't start to feel ill when you're getting to be 40. You hardly feel any different. You hardly even tire more easily. But you do know that your looks are no longer going to stop everybody dead for at least a few seconds, which they do when you're young, because they simply couldn't tell whether I was a man or a woman in my 20s. And this really did give them some pause. And, of course, later on this is not so. When I was 40, I stopped dyeing my hair red and started to dye it mauve, somewhat as it is now, so that people could see that my hair was dyed, but could not accuse me of dyeing it to look young. But, of course, by the time you're 50 or 60, you're old to the world. And it always amuses me that some famous actress will die, and then the news will be brought out that she wasn't really 92, she was 93. And you think, they've kept this weird secret all these years. And to a young person, if you said, no, actually, I'm not 60, I'm 70, they would say, oh, yes, because it's the same thing. There's no difference to young people. Anyone over 50 is one of them.
Why did you move from England to New York? How long has it been?
Well, I first came here for a few days in 1977. And I came because I was invited. I could never have paid my fare to America. I have never earned, as regular wages, more than £12 a week. That's $25 in a good year. So I would have been saving up for 3 years to spend 3 days in America. But when I was invited, I came here. And the moment I saw New York, I wanted it. But that's not surprising, because I've always been American in my heart. And the moment I saw the movies, I wished I lived in America.
You've lived a very bohemian life. Have you in any way become more conservative with age in terms of, you know, your lifestyle, your apartment, anything like that?
Well, I don't think so. I live in New York in the same way that I lived in London, in one room, in a rooming house. And I lived in England for over 40 years, in one room, in a rooming house. So that I don't think my life has grown any different. I would say my appearance is more moderate. But that would have happened merely by growing older, I think.
You've lived alone nearly all of your life.
Yes.
And you once referred to your home as your dressing room, like you like to go home, go back to your dressing
room.
Yes,
that's right. Because my life is lived so consciously in the world, whereas another person can just go out and buy some milk and come back again, I can't really do this because I expect that people may speak to me and talk to me and ask me why I buy milk or whatever. So that I am with the world every minute that I'm out of doors. I'm prepared to be with the world every minute I'm out of doors. My behavior, therefore, is always circumspect out of doors. When I get home, there has to be some time when I do absolutely nothing. And now, because I am older and I tire more easily, I try to have at least one day a week in which I never leave my room, so that I don't reconstruct myself, pull myself together, go out in that conscious way.
Do you see life as theater?
I see my life, yes, as theater. And, of course, in this I am aided and abetted by New Yorkers, because there never has been a city which was so totally given over to the big time as New York. Everybody is a secret actor.
You've said that to survive your life was an adventure and to reach old age was a miracle. Do you ever look back and think about people who are probably not with us any longer, who I'm sure warned you that the life that you're living was a dangerous life and that you'd get yourself into all kinds of trouble and you wouldn't live very long, you'd die of venereal disease or get beaten up in the streets. And here you are nearing 80, looking terrific. I mean, do you ever...
I am reminded of that. The other day, I can't think what did remind me, but I said I can remember. And someone said, not behind my back, but to my face, you'll never live through another winter. And I was about 24 then. But of course, I was very frail. The thing is, people mistake a vast physique for a good constitution. They're in no way connected. When younger, I seemed to have an invincible constitution. I just survived.
Quentin Crisp, recorded in 1986. He died last Sunday at the age of 90. This is Fresh Air.